of the State Department. Secret Service agents conducted him to the VIP elevator that took him to the 7th floor, where one of Brett Hansen's personal assistants led him to the double doors of the office of the Secretary of State. "Hello, Ed," Hansen said, standing and coming to meet the man he'd known in and out of public life for 2 decades. "Hi, Brett." Keelty was not downcast. In the past few weeks he'd come to terms with many things. Later today he would make his public statement apologizing to Barbara Linders and several other people by name. But before that he had to do what the Constitution required. Keelty reached into his coat pocket and handed over an envelope to the Secretary of State. Hansen took it and read the 2 brief paragraphs that announced Keelty's resignation from his office. There were no further words. The 2 old friends shook hands, and Keelty made his way back out of the building. He would return to the White House, where his personal staff was already collecting his belongings. By evening, the office would be ready for a new occupant. "Jack, Chuck Whiting is delivering our terms, and they're pretty much what you suggested last night." "You might catch some political heat from that," Ryan observed, inwardly relieved that President Durling was willing to run the risk. The man behind the ornate desk shook his head. "I don't think so, but if it happens, I can take it. I want orders to go out for our forces to stand down, defensive action only." "Good. It's going to be a long while before things return to normal." Jack nodded. "Yes, sir, but we can still manage things in as civilized a way as possible. Their citizens were never behind this. Most of the people responsible for it are already dead. We have to make that clear. Want me to handle it?" "Good idea. Let's talk about that tonight. How about you bring your wife in for dinner, just a private one for a change," the president suggested with a smile. "I think Kathy would like that." Professor Carolyn Ryan was just finishing up a procedure. The atmosphere in the operating room was more akin to something in an electronics factory. She didn't even have to wear surgical gloves, and the scrub rules here were nothing like those for conventional surgery. The patient was only mildly sedated while the surgeon hovered over the gun sight-like controls of her laser, searching around for the last bad vessel on the surface of the elderly man's retina. She lined up the crosshairs as carefully as a man taking down a Rocky Mountain sheep from 1/2 mile and thumbed the control. There was a brief flash of green light, and the vein was welded shut. "Mr. Redding, that's it," she said quietly, touching his hand. "Thank you, doctor," the man said somewhat sleepily. Kathy Ryan flipped off the power switch on the laser system and got off her stool, stretching as she did so. In the corner of the room, Special Agent Andrea Price, still disguised as a Hopkins faculty member, had watched the entire procedure. The 2 women went outside to find Professor Bernard Katz, his eyes beaming over his Bismarck mustache. "Yeah, Bernie," Kathy said, making her notes for Mr. Redding's chart. "You have room on the mantel, Kath?" That brought her eyes up. Katz handed over a telegram, still the traditional way of delivering such news. "You just bagged a Lasker Award, honey." Katz then delivered a hug that almost made Andrea Price reach for her gun. "Oh, Bernie, you earned it, doctor. Who knows, maybe you'll get a free trip to Sweden, too. 10 years of work. It's one hell of a clinical breakthrough, Kathy." Other faculty members came up then, applauding and shaking her hand. And for Carolyn Muller Ryan, M.D., F.A.C.S., it was a moment to match the arrival of a baby. Well, she thought, almost. Special Agent Price heard her beeper go off and headed to the nearest phone, taking the message down and returning to her principal. "Is it really that good?" she finally asked. "Well, it's about the top American award in medicine," Katz said while Kathy basked in the glow of respect from her colleagues. "You get a nice little copy of a Greek statue, the winged victory of Samothrace, I think, the goddess Nike. Some money, too, but mainly what you get is the knowledge that you really made a difference. She's a great doc." "Well, the timing is pretty good. I have to get her home and changed," Price confided. "What for?" "Dinner in the White House," the agent replied with a wink. "Her husband did a pretty good job, too." Just how good was a secret from nearly everyone, but not from the service, from whom nothing was secret. Ambassador Whiting, I wish to apologize to you, to your government, and to your people for what has happened. I pledge to you that it will not happen again. I also pledge to you that the people responsible will answer to our law, Koga said with great, if somewhat stiff, dignity. Prime Minister, your word is sufficient to me and to my government. We will do the utmost to restore our relationship, the ambassador promised. Deeply moved by the sincerity of his host, and wishing, as many had, that America had not cut his legs out only 6 weeks earlier. I will communicate your wishes to my government immediately. I believe that you will find our response to your position is highly favorable. I need your help, Yamata said urgently. What help is that? Tracking down Zhang Hansan had taken most of the day, and now the man's voice was as cold as his name. I can get my jet here, and from here I can fly directly to... That could be viewed as an unfriendly act against two countries. No, I regret that my government cannot allow that. Fool, he didn't add, don't you know the price for this sort of failure? But you... We are allies... "'Allies in what?' Zhang inquired. "'You are a businessman. "'I am a government official.' The conversation might have gone on with little point, but then the door to Yamata's office opened, and General Takekichi Arima came in, accompanied by two other officers. They hadn't troubled themselves to talk with the secretary in the anteroom. "'I need to speak with you, Yamata-san,' the general said formally. I'll get back to you, the industrialist said into the phone. He hung up. He couldn't know that at the other end the official instructed his staff not to put the calls through. It would not have mattered in any case. Yes, what is it? Yamata demanded. The reply was equally cold. I am ordered to place you under arrest.
By whom?
By Prime Minister Koga himself.
The charge?
Treason. Yamata blinked hard. He looked around the room at the other men, now flanking the general. There was no sympathy in their eyes. So there it was. These mindless automatons had orders, but not the wit to understand them. But perhaps they still had honor.
With your permission, I would like a few moments alone.
The meaning of the request was clear.
My orders, Arima said, are to return you to Tokyo alive. But I am sorry, Yamata-san, but you are not to avail yourself of that form of escape.
With that, the general motioned to the junior officer, who took three steps and handcuffed the businessman. The coldness of the steel startled the industrialist.
Tokikichi, you can't...
I must. It pained the general not to allow his friend... No, they'd not been friends, not really. Even so, it pained him not to allow Yamata to end his life by way of atonement, but the orders from the Prime Minister had been explicit on that score, and with that he led the man from the building off to the police station adjacent to his soon-to-be-vacated official quarters, where two men would keep an eye on him to prevent any attempt at suicide. When the phone rang, it surprised everyone that it was the phone and not Burroughs' satellite instrument. Isabella Reza got it, expecting a call from work or something. Then she turned and called,
Mr. Clark?
Thank you. He took it.
Yes?
John, Mary Pat,
your mission is over. Come on home.
Maintain cover?
Affirmative.
Good job, John. Tell Ding the same thing.
The line went dead. The DDO had already violated security in a major way, but the call had taken only a few seconds, and using the civilian line made it even more official than the covert sort could.
What gives? Portugee asked.
We've just been ordered home.
No shit, Ding asked.
Clark handed the phone over.
Call the airport. Tell them that we're accredited newsies and we might just get a priority.
Clark turned.
Portugee... Could you do me a favor and forget you ever saw me?
The signal was welcome, though surprising. Tennessee immediately turned due east and increased speed to 15 knots for the moment, staying deep. In the wardroom, the gathered officers were still joshing their army guest, as was also happening with the enlisted men. "We need a broom," the engineering officer said after some deep thought. "Do we have one aboard?" Lieutenant Shaw asked. "Every submarine is issued a broom, Mr. Shaw. You've been around long enough to know that," Commander Claggett observed with a wink. "What are you guys talking about?" the Army officer asked. "Were they jerking him around again?" "We took two shots, and both were kills," the engineer explained. "That's a clean sweep, and that means when we enter Pearl, we have a broom tied to the number one periscope. Tradition." "You squids do the weirdest things," the lone man in green fatigues observed. "Do we claim the helos?" Shaw asked his CO. "We shot them down," the ground pounder objected. "But they flew off our deck," the lieutenant pointed out. "Jesus! All this over breakfast. What would the squids do for lunch?" The dinner was informal up on the bedroom level of the White House with what passed for a light buffet, albeit one cooked by a staff good enough to upgrade the rating of any restaurant in America.
"I understand congratulations are in order," Roger Durling said.
"Huh?" The National Security Advisor hadn't heard yet.
"Jack, I got the Lasker," Kathy said from her seat across the table.
"Well, that's two in your family who are the best around," Al Trent observed, saluting with his wine glass.
"And this one's for you, Jack," the president said, lifting his glass. "After all the grief I've gotten on foreign affairs, you've saved me, and you've saved a lot of other things. Well done, Mr. Dr. Ryan."
Jack nodded at the toast, but this time he knew. He'd been around Washington long enough, finally, to hear the falling sandbag. The trouble was that he didn't know exactly why it was falling toward his head.
"Mr. President, the satisfaction comes from, well, from service, I guess. Thanks for trusting me, and thanks for putting up with me when I..."
"Jack, people like you, well, where would our country be?" Durling turned.
"Kathy, do you know everything Jack has done over the years?"
"Jack, tell me secrets?" She had a good laugh at that.
"Al?"
"Well, Kathy, it's time you learned," Trent observed, much to Jack's discomfort.
"There is one thing I've always wondered about," she said at once. "I mean, you two are so friendly, but the first time you met, several years ago, I..."
"The dinner, the one before Jack flew off to Moscow?"
Trent took a sip of the California Chardonnay.
"That was when he set up the defection of the head of the old KGB.
"What?"
"Tell the story, Al. We have lots of time," Durling urged. His wife, Anne, leaned in to hear this one, too. Trent ended up speaking for 20 minutes, telling more than one old tale in the process, despite the look on Jack's face.
"That's the sort of husband you have, Dr. Ryan," the president said when the stories were ended.
Jack looked over at Trent now, a rather intense stare. What was at the end of this?
"Jack, your country needs you for one last thing, and then we'll let you go," the congressman said.
"What's that?"
Please, not an ambassadorship, he thought, the usual kiss-off for a senior official.
Durling set his glass down. "Jack, my main job for the next 9 months is to get re-elected. It might be a tough campaign, and it's going to absorb a lot of my time under the best of circumstances. I need you on the team."
"Sir, I already am..."
"I want you to be my vice president," Durling said calmly. The room got very quiet then. "The post is vacant as of today, as you know. I'm not sure yet who I want for my second term, and I'm not suggesting that you fill the post for more than, what, not even 11 months, like Rockefeller did for Jerry Ford. I want somebody whom the public respects, somebody who can run the shop for me when I'm away. I need somebody heavy in foreign affairs.
I need somebody who can help me put my foreign policy team together, and, he added, I know you want out. You've had enough, and so after this, you can't be called back for a permanent post.
Wait a minute, I'm not even in your party, Jack managed to say.
As the Constitution was originally drafted, the Vice President was supposed to be the loser in the general election. James Madison and the others assumed that patriotism would triumph over partisanship. Well, they were wrong, Durling allowed. But in this case, Jack, I know you. I will not use you in a political sense. No speeches and baby kissing.
Never pick up a baby to kiss it, Trent said. They always puke on you, and somebody always gets a picture. Always kiss the baby in the mom's arms.
The good political advice was sufficient to lighten the atmosphere a little. Your job will be to get the White House organized, to manage national security affairs, really to help me strengthen my foreign policy team. And then I'll let you go, and nobody will ever call you back. You'll be a free man, Jack, Durling promised. Once and for all.
My God, Kathy said.
It's what you wanted too, isn't it?
Caroline nodded. Yes, it is, but I don't know anything about politics.
Lucky you, Ann Durling observed. You won't have to get stuck with it.
I have my work, and
you'll still do it. A nice house comes along with the job, the president went on. And it's temporary.
He turned his head.
Well, Jack?
What makes you think that I can be confirmed? Leave that to us, Trent said, in a way that announced quite clearly that it had already been settled.
You won't ask me to... My word on it, the president promised. Your obligation ends next January.
What about... I mean, that makes me president of the Senate, and in the event of a close vote,
I suppose I ought to say that I'll tell you how I want you to vote, and I will, and I hope you'll listen. But I know you'll vote your conscience. I can live with that. As a matter of fact, if you were any other way, I wouldn't be making this offer.
Besides, nothing on the schedule will be that close, Trent assured him. They talked that one over, too, the night before. I think we should pay more attention to the military, Jack said.
If you make recommendations, I'll incorporate them in the budget. You've taught me a lesson on that, and I may need you to help me hammer it through Congress. Maybe that will be your valedictory.
They'll listen to you, Jack, Trent assured him. Jesus, Ryan thought, wishing that he'd gone easier on the wine. Predictably, he looked over to his wife. Their eyes met, and she nodded. You sure? His eyes asked. She nodded again. Mr. President, under the terms of your offer and just to the end of your term.
Yes, I will do it.
Roger Durling motioned to a Secret Service agent, letting her know that Tish Brown could make the press release in time for the morning papers. Areza allowed himself to board his boat for the first time since Burroughs had landed his albacore. They left the pier at dawn, and by nightfall the engineer was able to conclude his fishing vacation with another sizable game fish before catching a continental flight to Honolulu. His return to work would include more than a fish story, but he wouldn't mention the gear that the boat's skipper had dumped over the side as soon as they were out of sight of land. It was a shame to dump the cameras and the expensive lights, but he supposed there was some reason for it. Clark and Chavez, still covered as Russians, managed to bully their way onto a JAL flight to Narita. On the way aboard, they saw a well-dressed man in handcuffs with a military escort, and from 20 feet away, as they moved the man into the first-class cabin, Ding Chavez looked into the eyes of the man who'd ordered the death of Kimberly Norton. He briefly wished for his light, or a gun, or maybe even a knife, but that was not in the cards. The flight to Japan took just over 2 boring hours, and both men walked their carry-ons across the international terminal. They had first-class reservations on another JAL flight to Vancouver, and from there they would fly to Washington on an American carrier. "Good evening," the captain said, first in Japanese, then in English.
"This is Captain Sato. We expect this to be a smooth flight, and the winds are good for us. With luck, we should be in Vancouver at about 7 in the morning local time." The voice sounded even more mechanical than the cheap ceiling speakers, but pilots liked talking like robots. "Thank God," Chavez observed quietly in English. He did the mental arithmetic and decided that they'd be in Virginia around 9 or 10 in the evening. "About right," Clark thought. "I want to marry your daughter, Mr. C. I'm going to pop the question when I get back." There, he'd finally said it. The look his offhand remark generated made him cringe. "Someday you'll know what words like that do to a man, Ding." "My little baby," he thought, "as vulnerable to the moment as any man, perhaps more so." "Don't you want a greaser in the family?" "No, not that at all. It's more..." "Oh, what the hell, Ding. Easier to spell Chavez and Wojohowitz. If it's okay with her, then I suppose it's okay with me." "That easy? I expected you to bite my head off." Clark allowed himself a chuckle. "No, I prefer guns for that sort of thing. I thought you knew that." The president could not have made a better selection, Sam Fellows said on Good Morning America. "I've known Jack Ryan for nearly 8 years. He's one of the brightest people in government service. I can tell you now that he's one of the men most responsible for the rapid conclusion of hostilities with Japan and was also instrumental in the recovery of the financial markets. There have been reports that his work at CIA, you know that I'm not free to reveal classified information. Those leaks would be handled by others, and the proper senators on both sides of the aisle were being briefed in this morning as well. I can say that Dr. Ryan has served our country with the utmost personal honor. I cannot think of another intelligence official who's earned the trust and respect that Jack Ryan has. But 10 years ago, the incident with the terrorists, have we ever had a vice president who actually killed people?" Fellows shook his head at the reporter. "A lot of presidents and vice presidents have been soldiers. Jack defended his family against a vicious and direct attack like any American would. I can tell you that out where I live in Arizona, nobody would fault a man for that." "Thanks, Sam," Ryan said, watching his office TV. The first wave of reporters was scheduled to assault him in 30 minutes, and he had to read over briefing materials plus a sheet of instructions from Tish Brown. "Don't speak too fast. Don't give a direct answer to any substantive political question." "I'm just glad to be here," Ryan said to himself. "I just play them one game at a time. Isn't that what they tell rookie ball players to say?" he wondered aloud. The 747 touched down even earlier than the pilot had promised, which was fine, but wouldn't help on the connecting flight. The good news for the moment was that the first-class passengers got off first. And better still, a U.S. consular official met Clark and Chavez at the gate, whisking them through customs. Both men had slept on the flight, but their bodies were still out of sync with the local time. An aging Delta 1011 lifted off 2 hours later, bound for Dulles International. Captain Sato remained in his command seat. One problem with international air travel was the sameness of it all. This terminal could have been almost anywhere, except that all of the faces were Gaijin. There would be a day-long layover before he flew back, doubtless full again of Japanese executives running away. And this was the remainder of his life, ferrying people he didn't know to places he didn't care about. If only he'd stayed in the self-defense forces, maybe he would have done better, maybe it would have made a difference. He was the best pilot in one of the world's best airlines, and those skills might have... But he'd never know, would he? And he'd never make a difference, just one more captain of one more aircraft flying people to and from a nation that had forfeited its honor. Well, he climbed out of his seat, collected his flight charts and other necessary papers, tucked them in his carry bag, and headed out of the aircraft. The gate was empty now, and he was able to walk down the bustling but anonymous terminal.
He saw a copy of USA Today at a shop and picked it up, scanning the front page, seeing the pictures there. Tonight at 9 o'clock. It all came together at that moment, really just an equation of speed and distance. Sato looked around once more, then headed off to the airport administrative office. He needed a weather map. He already knew the timing.
"One thing I'd like to fix," Jack said, more at ease than ever in the Oval Office.
"What's that?"
"A CIA officer. He needs a pardon."
"What for?" Durling asked, wondering if a sandbag was descending toward his own head.
"Murder," Ryan replied honestly.
"As luck would have it, my father worked the case back when I was in college. The people he killed had it coming. Not a good way to look at things, even if they did."
"They did," the vice president-designate explained for 2 or 3 minutes.
The magic word was drugs, and soon enough the president nodded.
"And since then?"
"One of the best field officers we've ever had. He's the guy who bagged Cotti and Gozan in Mexico City."
"That's the guy?"
"Yes, sir. He deserves to get his name back."
"Okay. I'll call the Attorney General and see if we can do it quietly."
"Any other favors that you need taken care of?" the president asked.
"You know, you're picking this political stuff up pretty fast for an amateur. Nice job with the media this morning, by the way."
Ryan nodded at the compliment.
"Admiral Jackson. He did a nice job, too, but I suppose the Navy will take good care of him."
"A little presidential attention never hurt any officer's career. I want to meet him anyway. You're right, though. Flying into the islands to meet with him was a very astute move."
"No losses," Chambers said, "and a lot of kills. Why didn't he feel good about that?"
"The subs that killed Charlotte and Asheville?" Jones asked.
"We'll ask when the time comes, but probably at least one of them. The judgment was statistical, but likely."
"Ron, good job," Mancuso said.
Jones stubbed out his cigarette. Now he'd have to break the habit again, and now, also, he understood what war was, and thanked God that he had never really had to fight in one. Perhaps it was just something for kids to do, but he'd done his part, and now he knew, and with luck he'd never have to see one happen again. There were always whales to track.
"Thanks, Skipper."
"One of our 747s has mechanicaled rather badly," Sato explained. "It will be out of service for 3 days. I have to fly to Heathrow to replace the aircraft. Another 747 will replace mine on the Pacific run."
With that, he turned over the flight plan.
The Canadian air traffic official scanned it.
"Pax?"
"No passengers, no. But I'll need a full load of fuel."
"I expect your airline will pay for that, Captain," the official observed with a smile. He scribbled his approval on the flight plan, keeping one copy for his records, and gave the other back to the pilot. He gave the form a last look.
"Southern routing? It's 500 miles longer."
"I don't like the wind forecast," Sato lied.
It wasn't much of a lie. People like this rarely second-guessed pilots on weather calls. This one didn't either.
"Thank you."
The bureaucrat went back to his paperwork.
An hour later, Sato was standing under his aircraft. It was at an Air Canada service hangar. The space at the terminal was occupied again by another international carrier. He took his time pre-flighting the airliner, checking visually for fluid leaks, loose rivets, bad tires, any manner of irregularity called hangar rash. But there was none to be seen. His co-pilot was already aboard, annoyed at the unscheduled flight they had to make, even though it meant 3 or 4 days in London, a city popular with international aircrew. Sato finished his walk around and climbed aboard, stopping first at the forward galley.
"Already?" he asked. "Pre-flight checklist complete, standing by for before-start checklist," the man said just before the steak knife entered his chest. His eyes were wide with shock and surprise rather than pain.
"I'm very sorry to do this," Sato told him in a gentle voice.
With that, he strapped into the left seat and commenced the engine start sequence. The ground crew was too far away to see into the cockpit and couldn't know that only one man was alive on the flight deck.
Vancouver Tower, this is JAL Ferry Flight 500 requesting clearance to taxi. 500 Heavy, Roger, you are clear to taxi runway 27 left. Winds are 280 at 15. Thank you, Vancouver. 500 Heavy cleared for 27 left. With that, the aircraft started rolling. It took 10 minutes to reach the end of the departure runway. Sato had to wait an extra minute because the aircraft ahead of his was another 747, and they generated dangerous wake turbulence. He was about to violate the first rule of flight, the one about keeping your number of takeoffs equal to that for landings, but it was something his countrymen had done before. On clearance from the tower, Sato advanced the throttles to takeoff power, and the Boeing, empty of everything but fuel, accelerated rapidly down the runway, rotating off before reaching 6,000 feet, and immediately turning north to clear the controlled airspace around the airport. The lightly loaded airliner positively rocketed to its cruising altitude of 39,000 feet, at which point fuel efficiency was optimum. His flight plan would take him along the Canadian-U.S. border, departing land just north of the fishing town of Hopedale. Soon after that, he'd be beyond ground-based radar coverage. 4 hours, Sato thought, sipping tea while the autopilot flew the aircraft. He said a prayer for the man in the right seat, hoping that the co-pilot's soul would be at peace, as his now was. The Delta flight landed at Dulles only a minute late. Clark and Chavez found that there was a car waiting for them. They took the official Ford and headed down to Interstate 64 while the driver who brought it caught a cab.
What do you suppose will happen to him?
Yamata? Prison? Maybe worse?
Did you get a paper? Clark asked. Yeah. Chavez unfolded it and scanned the front page.
Holy shit!
Huh?
Looks like Dr. Ryan's getting kicked upstairs.
But Chavez had other things to think about for the drive down toward the Virginia Tidewater, like how he was going to ask Patsy the big question. What if she said no? A joint session of Congress is always held in the House chamber due to its larger size, and also members of the lower house noted, because in the Senate seats were reserved and those bastards didn't let anyone else sit in their place. Security was usually good here. The Capitol building had its own police force, which was used to working with the Secret Service. Corridors were closed off with velvet ropes, and the uniformed officers were rather more alert than usual, but it wasn't that big a deal. The president would travel to the Hill in his official car, which was heavily armored, accompanied by several Chevy Suburbans that were even more heavily protected and loaded with Secret Service agents carrying enough weapons to fight off a company of Marines. It was rather like a traveling circus, really, and like people in the circus, they were always setting up and taking down. Four agents, for example, humped their Stinger missile containers to the roof, going to the customary spots, scanning the area to see if the trees had grown a little too much. They were trimmed periodically for better visibility. The Secret Service's counter-sniper team took similar perches atop the Capitol and other nearby buildings. The best marksmen in the country, they lifted their custom-crafted 7mm Magnum rifles from foam-lined containers and used binoculars to scan the rooftops they didn't occupy. There were few enough of those, as other members of the detail took elevators and stairs to the top of every building close to the one Jumper would be visiting tonight. When darkness fell, light amplification equipment came out, and the agents drank hot liquids in order to keep alert. Sato thanked Providence for the timing of the event and for the TCAS system. Though the transatlantic air routes were never empty, travel between Europe and America was timed to coincide with human sleep patterns, and this time of day was slack for westbound flights. The TCAS sent out interrogation signals and would alert him to the presence of nearby aircraft. At the moment there was nothing close. His display said clear of conflict, meaning that there was no traffic within 80 miles.
That enabled him to slip into a westbound routing quite easily, tracking down the coast, 300 miles out. The pilot checked his time against his memorized flight plan. Again, he'd figured the winds exactly right in both directions. His timing had to be exact, because the Americans could be very punctual. At 20-30 hours, he turned west. He was tired now, having spent most of the last 24 hours in the air. There was rain on the American East Coast, and while that would make for a bumpy ride lower down, he was a pilot and hardly noticed such things. The only real annoyance was all the tea he'd drunk. He really needed to go to the head, but he couldn't leave the flight deck unattended, and there was less than an hour to endure the discomfort.
"Daddy, what does this mean? Do we still go to the same school?" Sally asked from the rear-facing seat in the limousine. Kathy handled the answer. It was a mommy question.
"Yes, and you'll even have your own driver."
"Neat," little Jack thought.
Their father was having second thoughts, as he usually did after making an important decision, even though he knew it was too late for that. Kathy looked at his face, read his mind, and smiled at him.
"Jack, it's only a few months, and then..."
"Yeah," her husband nodded. "I can always work on my golf game,
and you can finally teach. That's what I want you to do. That's what you need to do."
"Not back to the banking business?"
"I'm surprised you lasted as long as you did in that."
"You're an eye cutter, not a pashrink."
"We'll talk about it," Professor Ryan said, adjusting Katie Ryan's dress.
It was the 11 months part that appealed to her. After this post, he'd never come back to government service again. What a fine gift President Durling had given them both. The official car stopped outside the Longworth House office building. There were no crowds there, though some congressional staffers were heading out of the building. 10 Secret Service agents kept an eye on them and everything else, while 4 more escorted the Ryans into the building. Al Trent was at the corner entrance.
"You want to come with me?"
"Why?" "After you're confirmed, we walk you in to be sworn, and then you take your seat behind the president, next to the speaker," Sam Fellows explained. "It was Tish Brown's idea. It'll look good."
"Election year theatrics," Jack observed coolly.
"What about us?" Kathy asked.
"It's a nice family picture," Al thought.
"I don't know why I'm so darned excited about this," Fellows grumbled in his most good-natured way. "This is going to make November hard for us. I suppose that never occurred to you."
"Sorry, Sam, no it didn't," Jack replied with a sheepish grin.
"This hovel was my first office," Trent said, opening the door on the bottom floor to the suite of offices he'd used for 10 terms. "I keep it for luck. Please sit down and relax a little." One of his staffers came in with soft drinks and ice under the watchful eyes of Ryan's protective detail. Andrea Price started playing with the Ryan kids again. It looked unprofessional, but was not. The kids had to be comfortable around her, and she'd already made a good start at that. President Durling's car arrived without incident. Escorts conveyed him to the speaker's official office adjacent to the chamber, where he went over his speech again. Jasmine, Mrs. Durling, with her own escorts, took an elevator to the official gallery. By this time the chamber was half-filled. It wasn't accepted for people to be fashionably late, perhaps the only such occasion for members of the Congress. They assembled in little knots of friends for the most part and walked in by party, the seats divided by a very real, if invisible, line. The rest of the government would come in later, all 9 justices of the Supreme Court, all members of the cabinet who happened to be in town, 2 were not, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in their beribboned uniforms were led to the front row. Then the heads of independent agencies, Bill Shaw of the FBI, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Finally, under the nervous eyes of security people and the usual gaggle of advance personnel, it was ready, on time, as it always seemed to happen. The 7 networks interrupted their various programming. Anchor persons appeared to announce that the presidential address was about to begin, giving the viewers enough information that they could head off to the kitchen and make their sandwiches without really missing anything. The doorkeeper of the house, holder of one of the choicest patronage jobs in the country, a fine salary and no real duties, walked halfway down the aisle and performed his one public function with his customary booming voice.
"Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States. Roger Durling entered the chamber, striding down the aisle with brief stops to shake hands, his red leather folder tucked under his arm. It held a paper copy of his speech in the event that the teleprompters broke. The applause was deafening and sincere. Even those in the opposition party recognized that Durling had kept his promise to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and as powerful a force as politics was, there was also still honor and patriotism in the room, especially at times like this. Durling reached the well, then climbed up to his place on the podium, and it was time for the Speaker of the House to do his ceremonial duty.
Members of the Congress, I have the distinct privilege and high honor to introduce the President of the United States. And the applause began afresh. This time there was the usual contest between the parties to see who could clap and cheer the loudest and the longest.
Okay, remember what happens.
Okay, Al. I go in, the Chief Justice swears me in, and I take my seat. All I have to do is repeat it all back.
Ryan sipped a glass of Coke and wiped sweaty hands on his trousers. A Secret Service agent fetched him a towel.
Washington Center, this is KLM 659er. We have an onboard emergency, sir.
The voice was in clipped aviator ease, the sort of speech that people used when everything was going to hell. The air traffic controller outside Washington noted the alphanumeric icon had just tripled in size on his scope and keyed his own microphone. The display gave course, speed, and altitude. His first impression was that the aircraft was making a rapid descent.
659er, this is Washington Center. State your intentions, sir.
Center, 659er, number one engine has exploded. Engines one and two lost. Structural integrity in doubt. So is controllability. Request radar vector, direct Baltimore.
The controller waved sharply to his supervisor, who came over at once.
Wait a minute, who is this? He interrogated the computer and found no strip information for KLM 659.
The controller keyed his radio.
659er, please identify. Over.
This reply was more urgent.
Washington Center, this is KLM 659er. We are 747 Charter. Inbound Orlando, 300 PAX, the voice replied.
Repeating, we have two engines out and structural damage to port wing and fuselage. I am descending 10,000 now. Request immediate radar vector direct Baltimore. Over.
We can't dick around with this, the supervisor thought.
Take him. Get him down.
Very well, sir. 659er heavy, radar contact. I read you 14,000 descending in 300 knots. Recommend left turn 290 and continue descent and maintain 10,000.
659er descending 10,000, turning left 290, Sato said in reply. English was the language on international air travel, and his was excellent. So far, so good. He had more than half of his fuel still aboard, and he was barely 100 miles out, according to his satellite navigation system. At Baltimore-Washington International Airport, the fire station, located near the main terminal, was immediately alerted. Airport employees who ordinarily had other jobs ran or drove to the building, while controllers decided quickly which aircraft they would continue to land before the wounded 747 got close and which they would have to stack. The emergency plan was already written here, as for every major airport. Police and other services were alerted, and literally hundreds of people were snatched away from TV sets.
I want to tell you the story of an American citizen, the son of a police officer, a former Marine officer crippled in a training accident, a teacher of history, a member of America's financial community, a husband and father, a patriot and public servant, and a genuine American hero, the president said on the TV.
Ryan cringed to hear it all, especially when followed by applause.
The cameras panned over Secretary of the Treasury Fiedler, who'd leaked Jack's role in the Wall Street recovery to a group of financial reporters. Even Brett Hansen was clapping, and rather graciously.
It's always embarrassing, Jack, Trent said with a laugh.
Many of you know him. Many of you have worked with him. I have spoken today with the members of the Senate.
Durling motioned to the majority and minority leaders, both of whom smiled and nodded for the C-SPAN cameras.
And with your approval, I wish now to submit the name of John Patrick Ryan to fill the post of Vice President of the United States. I further request the members of the Senate to approve this nomination tonight by voice vote.
That's pretty irregular, a commentator observed while the two senators stood to walk down to the well. President Durling has done his homework well on this, the political expert replied. Jack Ryan is about as non-controversial as people can be in this town, and the bipartisan...
Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and our friends and colleagues of the House, the majority leader began. It is with great satisfaction that the minority leader and I...
Are we sure this is legal? Jack wondered aloud.
The Constitution says that the Senate has to approve you. It doesn't say how, Sam Fellows said.
Baltimore approached. This is 659er. I have a problem here.
659er heavy. What's the problem, sir? The tower controller asked.
He could already see part of it on his scope. The inbound 747 hadn't turned to his most recent command as sharply as he had ordered a minute earlier. The controller wiped his hands together and wondered if they'd be able to get this one down.
My controls are not responding well.
Not sure I can.
Baltimore, I see runway lights at my 1 o'clock.
I don't know this area well.
Busy here. Losing power.
The controller checked the direction vector on his scope, extending it to
659er. That is Andrews Air Force Base. They have two nice runways. Can you make the turn for Andrews?
659er. I think so.
Stand by.
The controller had a hotline to the Air Force Base.
Andrews, we've been following it, the senior officer in that tower said.
Washington Center clued us in. Do you need help?
Can you take him?
Affirmative.
659er heavy, Baltimore, I'm going to hand you off to Andrews approach. Recommend turn right 350.
Can you do that, sir?
The controller asked.
I think I can.
The fire's out, I think.
But hydraulics are bottoming out on me.
I think the engine must have...
KLM 659er heavy, this is Andrews approach control. Radar contact 25 miles out, heading 340 at 4,000 feet, descending. Runway 01 left is clear, and our fire trucks are already moving, the Air Force captain said.
He'd already punched the base panic button, and his trained people were moving out smartly.
Recommend turn right 010 and continue descent.
659er was the only acknowledgment.
The irony of the situation was something Sato would never learn. Though there were numerous fighter aircraft based at Andrews, at Langley Air Force Base, at Patuxent River Naval Air Test Center, and at Oceana Naval Air Station, all within 100 miles of Washington, it had never occurred to anyone to have fighter aircraft aloft over the Capitol on any other night like this one.
His elaborate lies and maneuvers were hardly necessary at all.
Sato brought his aircraft around at a painfully slow rate to simulate a crippled jumbo, coached every degree of the way by a very concerned and professional American controller, and that he thought was too bad.
"Aye." "Opposed."
There was silence after that, followed a moment later by applause. Then the speaker stood.
The doorkeeper of the House will escort the Vice President into the chamber so that he can be properly sworn.
That's your cue. Break a leg, Trent said, standing and heading for the door.
The Secret Service agents fanned out along the corridor, leading the procession to the tunnel connecting this building with the Capitol.
Entering it, Ryan looked along the curving structure, painted an awful off-yellow and lined, oddly enough, mostly with pictures done by school children.
"I don't see any obvious problem. No smoke or fire." The tower controller had his binoculars on the incoming aircraft. It was only a mile out now.
No gear. 659er, your gear is up. Say again, your gear is up.
Sato could have replied, but chose not to. It was really all decided now. He advanced his throttles, accelerating his aircraft up from approach speed of 160 knots, holding to his altitude of 1,000 feet for the moment. The target was in view now, and all he had to do was turn 40 degrees left. On reflection, he lit up his aircraft, displaying the red crane on the rudder fin.
What the hell is he doing? That's not KLM. Look, the junior officer pointed. Directly over the field, the 747 banked left, clearly under precise control, all four engines whining with increased power. Then the two looked at each other, knowing exactly what was going to happen and knowing that there was literally nothing that could be done. Calling the base commander was just a formality that would not affect events at all. They did that anyway, then alerted the first helicopter squadron as well. With that, they ran out of options and turned to watch the drama whose conclusion they'd already guessed. It would take a little over a minute to conclude. Sato had been to Washington often and done all the usual tourist things, including visiting the Capitol building more than once. It was a grotesque piece of architecture, he thought again, as it grew larger and larger, and he adjusted his flight path so that he was now roaring right up Pennsylvania Avenue, crossing the Anacostia River. The sight was sufficiently stunning that it momentarily paralyzed the Secret Service agent standing atop the House chamber, but it was only a moment, and ultimately meaningless. The man dropped to his knees and flipped the cover off the large plastic box. "Get jumper moving, now!" the man screamed, taking out the stinger. "Let's go!" an agent shouted into his microphone, loudly enough to hurt the ears of the protective detail inside. A simple phrase for the Secret Service, it meant to get the President away from wherever he was. Instantly, agents as finely trained as any NFL backfield started moving even though they had no idea what the danger was. In the gallery over the chamber, the First Lady's detail had a shorter distance to go, and though one of the agents tripped on the step, she was able to grab Ann Durling's arm and start dragging her away. "What?" Andrea Price was the only one to speak in the tunnel. The rest of the agents around the Ryan family instantly drew their weapons, pistols for the most part, though two of their number pulled out submachine guns. All of them brought their weapons up and scanned the yellow-white corridor for danger, but there was none to be seen. "Clear, clear, clear." On the floor of the chamber, six men raced to the podium, also scanning about with drawn weapons, in a moment that millions of television viewers would fix in their minds forever. President Durling looked at his chief agent in genuine puzzlement, only to hear a screamed entreaty to move at once. The Stinger agent atop the building had his weapon shouldered in record time, and the beeping from the missile tracker told him that he had acquisition. Not a second later, he loosed his shot, knowing even then that it didn't matter a damn. Ding Chavez was sitting on the couch holding Patsy's hand, the one with a ring now on it, until he saw the people with guns. The soldier he would always be leaned into the TV to look for danger, but seeing none, he knew that it was there even so. The streak of light startled Sato, and he flinched somewhat from surprise rather than fear, then saw the missile heading for his left inboard engine. The explosion was surprisingly loud, and alarms told him that the engine was totally destroyed, but he was a mere 1,000 meters away from the white building. The aircraft dipped and yawed slightly to the left. Sato compensated for it without a thought, adjusting trim and nosing down for the south side of the American House of Government. They would all be there, the President, the parliamentarians, all of them. He selected his point of impact just as finely as any routine landing, and his last thought was that if they could kill his family and disgrace his country, then they would pay a very special price for that. His last voluntary act was to select the point of impact, 2/3 of the way up the stone steps. That would be just about perfect, he knew. Nearly 300 tons of aircraft and fuel struck the east face of the building at a speed of 300 knots. The aircraft disintegrated on impact. No less fragile than a bird, its speed and mass had already fragmented the columns outside the walls. Next came the building itself. As soon as the wings broke up, the engines, the only really solid objects on the aircraft, shot forward, one of them actually smashing into and beyond the House chamber. The Capitol has no structural steel within its stone walls, having been built in an age when stone piled on stone was deemed the most long-lasting form of construction. The entire east face of the building's southern half was smashed to gravel, which shot westward. But the real damage took a second or two more, barely time for the roof to start falling down on the 900 people in the chamber. 100 tons of jet fuel erupted from shredded fuel tanks, vaporizing from the passage through the stone blocks. A second later, it ignited from some spark or other, and an immense fireball engulfed everything inside and outside the building. The volcanic flames reached out, seeking air and corridors that held it, forcing a pressure wave throughout the building, even into the basement. The initial impact was enough to drop them all to their knees, and now the Secret Service agents were on the edge of real panic. Ryan's first instinctive move was to grab his youngest daughter, then to push the rest of the family to the floor and cover them with his body. He was barely down when something made him look back north up the tunnel. The noise came from there, and a second later there was an advancing orange wall of flame. There was not even time to speak. He pushed his wife's head down, and then two more bodies fell on top to cover them. There wasn't time for anything else but to look back at the advancing flames. Over their heads, the fireball had already exhausted the supply of oxygen. The mushrooming cloud leaped upwards, creating its own mini-storm and sucking air and gas out of the building, whose occupants it had already killed. It stopped, not 100 feet away, then pulled away as rapidly as it had advanced. And there was an instant hurricane in the tunnel, going the other way. A door was wrenched off its hinges, sliding toward them but missing. His little Katie screamed with terror and pain at all the weight on her. Kathy's eyes were wide, looking at her husband. "Let's go," Andrea Price screamed before anyone else, and with that the agents lifted every member of the family, carrying, dragging them back to the Longworth building, leaving the two house members to catch up on their own. That required less than a minute, and then Special Agent Price was the first again. "Mr. President, are you okay?" "What the hell?" Ryan looked around, moving to his kids. Their clothing was disheveled, but they seemed otherwise intact. "Kathy, I'm okay, Jack." She checked the children next, as she had once done for him in London. "They're okay, Jack. You?" There was a thundering crash that made the ground shake, and again Katie Ryan screamed. "Bryster Walker," the female agent said into her microphone. "Bryster Walker. Anybody, check in now." "Price, this is Long Rifle 3. It's all gone, man. The dome just went down, too. Is Swordsman okay?" "What the hell was that?" Sam Fellows gasped from his knees. Price didn't have time even to hear the question. "Affirmative, affirmative. Swordsman, surgeon, and shit, we don't have names for them yet. The kids are... Everybody's okay here." Even she knew that was an exaggeration. Air was still racing past them into the tunnel to feed the flames in the Capitol building. The agents were recovering their composure somewhat now. Their guns were still out, and had so much as a janitor appeared in the corridor right then, his life might have been forfeit. But one by one they breathed deeply and relaxed just a little, at the same time trying to focus in on what they had been trained to do. "This way," Price said, leading with her pistol in both hands. "Rifle 3, get a car to the southeast corner of Longworth, and do it now." "Roger." "Billy, Frank, take point," Price commanded next. Jack hadn't thought she was the senior agent on the detail, but the two male agents weren't arguing. They sprinted ahead to the end of the corridor. Trent and Fellows just watched, waving the others on their way. "Clear," the one with the Uzi said at the far end of the corridor. "Are you okay, Mr. President?" "Wait a minute. What about Jumper is dead?" Price said simply. The other agents had heard the same radio chatter and had formed a very tight ring around their principal. Ryan had not, and was still disoriented and trying to catch up. "We have a Suburban outside," Frank called. "Let's go." "Okay, sir. The drill is to get you the hell away from here. Please follow me," Andrea Price said, lowering her weapon just a little. "Wait, now wait a minute. What are you saying? The President, Helen, Rifle 3, this is Price. Anybody get out?" "No chance, Price. No chance," the sniper replied. "Mr. President, we have to get you to a place of safety. Follow me, please." It turned out that there were two of the oversized vehicles. Jack was forcibly separated from his family and pushed into the first one. "What about my family?" he demanded, now seeing the orange pyre that had been the centerpiece of America's government only 4 minutes earlier. "Oh, my God. We take them to the Marine barracks at 8th and I Streets. I want Marines around them, okay?" Later, Ryan would remember that his first presidential order was something from his own past. "Yes, sir," Price keyed her mic. "Surgeon and kids, go to 8th and I. Tell the Marines they're coming." His vehicle just headed down New Jersey Avenue, away from the hill, Ryan saw. and for all their sophisticated training, the Secret Service people were mainly trying to clear the area. "Come around north," Jack told them. "Sir, the White House, a place with TVs, and right now, I think we need a judge, too." That idea didn't come from reason or analysis, Jack realized. It just came. The Chevy Suburban headed well west.